Hello, everybody. Welcome to a new episode of the Dissenter. I'm your host, as always, Ricardo Lopes, and today I'm joined for a second time by Dr. Todd Cashton. He's professor of psychology at George Mason University. Last time we talked about his latest book, The Art of Insubordination, and today we're going to talk about the psychology of well-being. So, Dr. Cashton, welcome back to the show. It's a pleasure to have you on.
Glad to be a repeat audience member.
So, well-being then. What are we talking about exactly from a psychological perspective? I mean, what are the aspects of psychology and of one's life that it involves?
Yeah, it's more controversial and complicated than people think, but you can break it down, at least our team breaks it down into a feeling of frequent satisfying emotions and a sense of fulfillment in your life. So one has an emotional resonance in terms of how you view yourself, the world, and your existence. And the other one is this cognitive evaluation, which is like a thumbs up or thumbs down for how's your existence going and how you imagine your existence going.
And how do we measure it?
Well, this has been challenging because people have often used psychological strengths and psychological benefits as what well-being is, when often they're the consequence of well-being. So even positive emotions, while you can say to yourself, that is the je ne sais quoi of what well-being is, we also know is that's often the fruits of satisfying psychological needs, such as the need to belong, the need to feel competent, the need to feel a sense of meaning in your life. Often the outpouring of that is you're feeling more positive about your life. So really the best way of measuring well-being is having these multiple dimensions. It's not one thing. So in the world of Gallup, their for-profit organization, they often measure it with Cantrell's ladder, where you have these different rungs, and you're basically asked this one item question, which is imagine your life, and the lowest rung is the worst possible life for yourself, and the highest rung is your most aspirational ideal. Where would you situate yourself on this ladder? And it's an extremely good one item measure, but as we know as scientists, a one item measure, you can't tell whether it's reliable because there's only a single, everything hinges on a three versus a five. So there's a little bit too much pressure because not everyone takes it as seriously and can distinguish between being on the third rung and the fifth rung.
But when it comes to how it's studied, I mean, are we completely dependent on things like surveys and self-reports, or is there any way of more experimentally and objectively studying it?
This is a really good question. Because to me, this comes up a lot, is there really a better way to ask, how's your life going for you, than asking someone and getting some response, whether it's an interview, your verbal and nonverbal behavior, or just in your answers in a survey? You can do things. So there's a thing called the ear, for example, an electronic activating recorder. I would have a device, very small, kind of like a hearing aid, and it would be collecting ambient sounds in my naturalistic environment, taking snippets every few minutes of my life. And then some 18-year-old who wants to get research experience has the horrible, horrendous task of going through and coding qualitatively what's going on in all those ambient moments, those 30-second snippets that's being grabbed, and you can see to what degree is someone socializing, to what degree is someone laughing, to what degree is someone seeming cogitative and contemplative about their life. And so that's a little bit more of an objective recorder. And to deal with the criticisms of that kind of innovation, you can say, well, maybe they're self-conscious, so they're presenting themselves in a particular light. But over the course of time, you forget that this thing is actually collecting, the sounds of your social world.
But just to perhaps tease apart a little bit more what kinds of studies people should look into when they're trying to understand how people are doing in terms of their well-being, does it connect in any way to studies on happiness, for example?
Oh, well, happiness is that's the big kahuna of the dimensions of well-being. So this is a sense of the degree to which you believe that you have more frequent positive compared to negative emotional experiences, and that view that you view your life as joyous or serene or tranquil. So one has a high energy state, the joyous part, one has a low energy state, the contentment, equanimity part. You often see cultural differences. So in East Asia, on average, you see more of a tendency to view happiness as calm, serene, content. And then in, Eastern Europe and in America and Canada, you often see people have it as I felt a high frequency of intrigue and excitement and joy and love. And so there are differences there where, again, you get to a really hard measurement question. If you load up too many questions or items involving high energy emotions, people in Asian countries are going to look like they're less happy when really their definition is more contingent on these low energy pleasant experiences.
So when studying well-being, we certainly have to take account the cultural variation.
Yeah, and that's and as good as anybody is we are horrendous as a field still. So as much as we talk about, the world is flat and there are, nearly 200 countries in the world, most of our studies are based on, the same 10 or 15 westernized, educated, industrial, democratic countries around the world.
Yeah, so we still have that kind of issue when it comes to studying well-being. That's another domain where studies are mostly focused on these Western countries, right?
Yeah, we're getting a nice set of epidemiological studies, which are studying multiple countries. So Aaron Jardine led an initiative, for example, where he studied people on six of seven continents in the world. And then you can test of the nature of well-being, the degree to which happiness is linked with physical health. Is that difference stronger or weaker in, in certain countries like Romania versus Japan versus Cambodia? You can ask those questions. And these are important questions. And then you have a question about the questions, which is if you find a difference in the link between happiness and indicators of physical health, such as, the amount of white blood cells in your body, is that because happiness is lower, or that because happiness isn't properly measured or understood by people in those countries? And those are perfectly confounded unless you do further studies beyond just looking for cross-cultural differences.
So I would like to ask you more now about what characterizes psychologically or tends to characterize psychologically people who report higher levels of well-being. So, is there a correlation with future orientation? I mean, are people who experience high levels of well-being, do they tend to be future-oriented or not necessarily?
So there's a correlation. It's not as high as you might think. So this idea of being having a not even a positive outlook of the future, but you are envisioning what could my future possibly be. That mentality, you can break it down to two parts. One is healthier, which you might call pondering the future, and one is less healthy, which you can call ruminating or perseverating about what's possible in the future or worrying that happens there. So real quickly, you can see, even with just a simple binary approach, if you're the type of person that ponders what's possible, what you can do, what I've learned from the past, how I want to change my behavior in the future, those are all signs of someone that's going to be engaging healthier behavior and feel good because they feel a sense of agency that they are in control to some degree in their life. And then someone who's ruminating, perseverating about why didn't I raise my hand in class? Like, why didn't I ask for a promotion at work? Why am I still stuck in the same job and I've been complaining about the same thing for the past 3 years? You're thinking about the future in terms of how you were stuck engaging in the same dysfunctional patterns repeatedly, and you're not seeing that healthy of possibilities in the future. So in that case, you're going to be reporting low well-being. Two people, still a future orientation, but the way that you think, even though these are two people that are overthinking, is a big influential factor of whether you're going to experience well-being or not.
But when it comes specifically to planning for the future, I mean, there are people who are more long-term oriented and others who are more short-term oriented. So, I mean, does that influence well-being or not?
Well, so think about it from an evolutionary perspective. So
Okay.
you could have two life history approaches where you have a fast approach in terms of you're thinking of short-term and moderate-term benefits. So this often is studied in the context of mating behavior. Are you looking for nice flings that give you joy, excitement, and love and meaning? Are you looking for moderate flings because you're looking for matches for what you like and what you dislike? Or are you thinking for the long term in terms of I want to have someone where I want to craft this life and all these experiences, with an individual? And in terms of well-being, I'm not sure there's that much of a difference. Now, for the partners, there might be if there's a mismatch where your partner's looking for a long-term situation, you're looking for a short-term situation, you're going to have a problems in terms of well-being for the partner. But for the individual themselves, it's really about honoring what you value. And if you value having a short-term set of really intriguing, interesting experiences, then a short-term mentality is going to increase your well-being in that. And if you're interested in terms of stability and life satisfaction over the course of different chapters in your life, then having a long-term perspective is going to be relevant to well-being, which really gets to the larger point is there are multiple pathways to getting to the same outcome, which scientists like to call equifinality.
So we'll get a little bit more into individual variation and perhaps some personality traits and other psychological traits that link to well-being. But in this case, we could say perhaps that it depends on each person's interests.
Well, you do often have a few categories that are really continuums for thinking about this, right? So if you have a long-term strategy versus short-term strategy of approaching your lifetime, you're future-oriented and planning either way. But just the time perspective is a psychological dimension here. And some people have a truncated timeline, and some people have much a more elongated timeline. And it's worthwhile just thinking about it, anyone listening, like what's your psychological perspective on time at this point in your life? And then there's the Dr. Phil question, which is, how's that working for you?
Yeah, I mean, I'm also asking you these questions because I guess it's important, if that's the case, of course, for people to understand that there's probably not one single way of achieving well-being that works for everyone.
Yeah, and even more than that is that you can imagine that everyone has this well-being matrix, and you have, let's just come up with a number and say there's 37 dimensions in your matrix. It's not just like how high or low is your well-being, it's what makes you experience well-being in what particular way in the current time frame. So there's this great work by Julie Norham where she talks about the opposite of having this positive future outlook, which is defensive pessimism. And that's that I'm not thinking that there's going to be a positive outcome in the future, and I'm not thinking I'm going to be responsible for the positive outcome. Instead, I am hoping for the best, bracing for the worst. I tend to be anxious, but the anxiety fuels me to solve problems that I'm imagining are going to come up in the future. Now, what's really cool about her work is she finds the types of situations where this leads to well-being. So one of her sets of studies shows that if you are a racial minority in a predominantly white university, being a defensive pessimist leads to more well-being and better academic achievement, and achievement is one dimension of well-being compared to people that are optimistic. And if you're in the middle of an epidemic, so the SARS epidemic or the Ebola outbreak, or more recently, kind of, the COVID situation that we're still kind of flittering around with, is that those people that are defensive pessimists tend to experience more well-being because they are acknowledging, embracing, and trying to deal with an actual problem that exists. And that while it is anxiety provoking, and they're low on the dimension of high frequency of negative emotions, low frequency of positive emotions, but they feel meaning, they feel a sense of autonomy, they feel competent, and they feel as if they have an internal locus of control and that they have a sense that they can change their lives. So on some dimensions, they are far better than optimists.
For people to experience well-being, do they need to have goals in life? In other words, are people who report high levels of well-being usually goal-oriented or not?
So in general, yes, right? So the idea of you have direct passions and pursuits that you are thinking about, you are developing, you are investing your most important currencies, your time, your energy, even your financial resources into, you have a mission in life. And having a mission in life is a really important pathway for developing all different, not even just well-being, but the benefits of having a life that's well lived that happen there. And there are often different words for the same concept. So Bob Emmons talks about having these personal strivings, these pursuits that you're kind of there that are guiding and organizing how you live your life. Brian Little talks about life projects, where it's kind of a similar realm, and they could be social, they can be intrapersonal, they can be achievement oriented, they could be relationship oriented. And then you've got this work that, follows the lines of Viktor Frankl, which is what we study in our lab, purpose in life. And if you have this central self-organizing principle that guides what your identity is, then you have this stable architectural framework where you can experience more richness in your life because you know that there's a why for your existence. And there's some really good work by a number of teams right now that even in teenagers and adolescents, you find that those that have a strong sense of purpose in life, they're physically healthier, they have better relationships. And then there's even some cool work by my friend Anthony Burrow showing if you are reminded of your purpose in life, you tend to show less racial prejudice in public places, such as being on a train or subway.
What about morality? Do people need to be good people for them to experience well-being?
We'd like to say so, and if we're thinking as a collective, it would be great if you have a strong ethical code, starting with the golden rule of, treat other people like you would treat yourself. If you have the Hippocratic oath of at first do no harm, but we know that this isn't the case, and just by research on people that are high on the dark triad. So I'm sure you've probably talked about this before on your podcast, but this is basically if you're high in narcissism, sense of entitlement, sense of inflated self-esteem, if you're high in psychopathy, you have a deficit in empathy, you don't really experience fear, and you could actually have this disinhibition in terms of just walking through life as if no one else matters, and you have this Machiavellianism where you are basically walking through the world selfishly. Those people with the dark triad are high in those dimensions. Plenty of them experience well-being because they don't give a crap about what other people's, how they affect other people. And so while they might be causing damage and from a moral ethical standpoint in terms of ruining the lives of once friends, coworkers, and tossed romantic partners, they're relatively oblivious and don't care. So they often are enjoying themselves.
Are there any particular psychological traits, like, for example, personality traits that correlate more or less with well-being?
Yes, so we can walk through the Big Five, which I'm sure has come up many a times. I use the OCEAN acronym to remember this. So you can go through the Big Five. So openness to experience, that's where you get curiosity and intellect. That has a very small positive correlation with well-being dimensions. Things like meaning and purpose in life, openness to experience has a higher correlation with that. Conscientiousness, rebranded but as grit by Angela Duckworth and others, where this is highly linked also as well with a sense of positive emotions, a sense of optimism, a sense of meaning in life. It's not the long-term pursuit. It's having the passionate interest. That's the piece that leads people to have higher levels of well-being. People that are more agreeable, kind, generous, compassionate, that's a high link with well-being. People that are more extroverted, while it's controversial, the data is that if you tend to enjoy having the attentional spotlight directed on you, as opposed to an introvert, you tend to extract more positive experiences when you're in social scenarios. And much of our life is spent as social creatures. And then the one with the strongest link to well-being ends up being neuroticism or having emotional instability in your life. And this is inversely related to well-being. The more emotionally unstable you are, the harder it is to experience well-being. And it's really, if you wanted to understand that, it's because you were pulled and pushed by what's happening in the environment in terms of you're reacting really strongly and often negatively, and you can't control a lot of things in your world. You can't control what other people say, what other people do, and people that are high in neuroticism, they end up reacting with this real sense of life is punishing to me attitude, and that detracts from their well-being, that personality trait.
So that's about personality, and earlier you also mentioned the dark triad, for example. Are there any other individual, I mean, is there other trait, are there other traits that vary individually that also correlate in any way to well-being?
Oh, yeah. I mean, tremendously. So, people that are high in spirituality. So, you can break spirituality and religiosity. I'm making this complicated, but psychology is complicated. That's why we're studying people, not rats. Is that there's three ways of being spiritual or religious. So, one way is having this internal sense of religiosity or spirituality. This is a core part of me of transcending the self and thinking that there's something beyond the self that I should be focusing on, this pro-social approach to the world of I'm thinking about what I do, how it relates to the species at large. I have a sense of awe about things that are bigger and more complicated and beautiful than I can understand. So if you internalize that, that's linked very highly to well-being. If it's external, in terms of the reasons or the motivation for why you're spiritual or religious, all of your friends are that way, all of your family are that way. You like the idea of being the type of person that cares a little bit less about yourself. But if it's for extrinsic reasons to win affection or approval, well, that's negatively linked to well-being. And then there's this, my favorite one is the quest mentality, is you're searching for something beyond the self. You're searching constantly for meaning and self-transcendence. In this case, to my surprise, the research is that this is also inversely related to well-being. And it's because there's a little bit of a struggle, is that you're trying to understand yourself in the world and you don't have happiness per se. You don't have the sense of joy, but you do have the meaning element of well-being, which is, important, is that you are on the quest to search for meaning in the hopes that you actually acquire meaning and then you can say, I had a meaningful, happy existence. But the quest mentality is a challenging one, and yet it is so fundamental to identity that we can say it's important, even if in the short term it detracts from your well-being. It's beneficial in the longer term because the only way that you acquire that great, profound sense of meaning in life is serendipity. It falls into your lap, cool people, cool books, or you actually actively explore this, or you have difficult adversity and you come through the other side and kind of really, as you're thinking about what happened and how you've changed, you can have this sense of growth that comes from adversity. Those are the three pathways, and they're all, the quest is only one pathway for actually deriving meaning through the world.
To what extent do levels of well-being in a single individual respond to life events, like negative or positive ones?
Someone who's higher on well-being? So if you are the type of person that's experiencing well-being, you are more inclined to attribute positive events to something that you did or something or someone who you are, as opposed to other people, luck, or random factors that are involved in there. So this attributional style is part of someone that's high in well-being. And then the other one is, when you have negative events that are inevitable, you're going to be rejected, you're going to feel lonely, you're going to fail at tasks. This isn't the Silicon Valley motivational poster, like, fail fast, fail often. It's going to happen regardless of the poster. Is you're more likely to find things that you can learn from these experiences, the silver linings effect, and then you could derive positive experiences even from a negative experiences. You can derive an awareness that I have the strength of perseverance. I have the strength of foresight. I have the strength of judgment and discernment, even though your emotional well-being might have taken a hit from an adverse event or a hardship.
Do levels of well-being change across the lifespan? For example, as we get older, do we tend to experience more or less well-being, for example?
So Arthur Brooks just wrote a book about this. He's an Atlantic journalist and talks a lot about this research. And the most modern research is that after around or close to around the age of 40 is that you often see an increase of well-being over the lifespan, and it's pretty stable over the course of time. There's some small, perturbations as you wake up out of bed and your lower back starts to hurt, and it's no longer easy to be flexible and go wrestle someone at 15 minutes after waking up. And you can't digest all the foods the same you could anymore. All of a sudden you have a lot more gas in your system and you don't know where, why, or how. And if you eat, a whole pie of pizza at 3 o'clock in the morning, you're going to see it in your obliques compared to in your 20s. Despite all of these factors, is that we tend to see a higher level, and there's a number of psychological mechanisms. One of them is there's a greater appreciation of life and people in your life because you're focused on the scarcity of time left in your life as opposed to this unlimited amount of possible experiences that you can have. And also, you develop the wisdom of that you can figure out what are the type of people that reliably provide me satisfaction, laughter, and make me feel cared for, understood, and validated. And so you're seeking out people that are known entities, reliable entities that can provide a reservoir of well-being, as opposed to when you're younger, you're still developing your social network in greater detail. So you have more of a novelty approach of, I just want to meet a whole bunch of people and find my tribe in there. That wisdom at the age of 40 onward is one of the mechanisms, arguably, that's why well-being is higher in older adults compared to people in their 20s and 30s.
What are psychological strengths and are they related also to well-being?
I mean, some ways, psychological strengths is really those personality traits that tend to lead more reliably to adaptive or healthy outcomes. So even part of the Big Five, we can say is that, underneath conscientiousness is, and you've referenced this earlier in this conversation, is being goal-oriented is a psychological strength. Being forgiving, which is under the umbrella of agreeableness, is a psychological strength. Having a love of learning, which is under the umbrella of openness to experience, is a psychological strength. Curiosity, dispositionally, that you walk through the world seeking novelty and appreciating novelty and trying to understand things, well, that's a psychological strength. And so really it's behavior that you engage in consistently that leads to high performance in whatever outcome that's desirable to you. It's something that you do regularly. That's how you get to say that you have this strength. And it's something that you feel energized when you're engaging this behavior. Now, this is pretty important because if you tend to be an extremely kind person and you hold the door for people, and on dates you open the door for your date to come into your car, which is almost antiquated, but shouldn't be antiquated. And you're the type of person that spends a lot of time mentoring people who know a little bit less than you and it's enjoyable for you and it's incredibly valuable to them. All of these behaviors lead to high performance as defined by better social interactions, higher likelihood of healthy, developed, or maintained social relationships. But if it doesn't charge you up, if it's not something that actually that you feel a sense of vitality for doing, we would say you don't really have a strength. You have a skill that when used is desirable, but it's not part of your identity per se, because it's not something that you would choose to do. It's just you're really good at it. You get reinforced. People tell you, listen, you have amazing interpersonal strengths. But so this energy part is an important element in defining what's a psychological strength to a person versus what's a learned behavior to a person.
So this now is something that I think we talked a little bit about in our first interview, but just to recap a little bit, what is psychological flexibility and is it also connected in any way or is it an essential ingredient of well-being?
Yeah, I mean, I think you know that's almost like almost the name of the paper that John Rottenbach and I wrote in 2010, that psychological flexibility is fundamental to well-being. And the research over the past, how many years has it been? 12 years has sort of borne that out even more. So there's really four ways of thinking about psychological flexibility. And the reason it's worth spending time on this, to me, it's like a meta strength. It's like it's better than having a strength. Is having an awareness of the psychological toolbox that's at your disposal. So here's four ways of thinking about psychological flexibility, starting with my favorite one, which is pursuing valued aims, or as you've been talking about, pursuing valued goals despite the presence of pain. So you have setbacks internally, you're a little bit discombobulated, and still you're able to pursue this because it matters so much to me. That's one definition. The other one is be able to shift perspectives. So, as a father of three daughters, right before our conversation now, I just walked my daughter to school. I am totally honed in on this role and perspective of, hey, my kids' attention is fundamentally important, and what they're thinking about is far more important, and I'm far more focused on it than whatever I'm thinking about and any other adult that wants to talk to me in the vicinity. I am kid focused. I am centered on them. I am compassionate and I'm listening. As soon as I drop her off and I see a bunch of other parents and we're working in the same direction, I'm shifting perspectives now. Now we're having conversation with adults who are talking about maybe their business partners that I might go into an adventure with. Maybe they're people that actually have knowledge in areas that I'd love to know about, such as, you know, the Virginia elections, the midterm elections between presidents is occurring in a couple of days. And maybe they want to access that level of resources. For me to shift from being kid focused, talking about Halloween, which just happened this weekend, and now I'm focusing on people that have knowledge about, you know, the financial markets and who to vote for in an upcoming election, that requires a mental shift. That's psychological flexibility. The other third one is reconfiguring your resources. What traits and what social capital, and with my limited finance, time, and energy, how do I reconfigure my resources to go have a conversation with Ricardo for an hour? So you have to think about what I wanted to do before in terms of what do I drink? How do I exercise? How do I take care of my mind and body? That's psychological flexibility. And then finally, a fourth definition is how do you balance the different multiple roles and multiple domains of your life and multiple time perspectives? You've got a past, we're living in the present, having a conversation now, or people are listening or paying attention to kind of some psychological knowledge. And then we have a future in terms of the things that we're going to be doing later. How do you balance these perspectives? How do you balance your psychological needs? How do you balance being a parent, a friend, a romantic partner, someone trying to educate the public about science? Being, you know, being a son, being a cousin, doing all that effectively is under the rubric of psychological flexibility.
Is psychological flexibility something that also varies across individuals?
Oh, yeah. Actually, I love that you said this. And actually, we didn't include this in any of our articles. You have this quality in a different way depending on which area you're thinking about. So as a parent, you might be relatively psychologically rigid. You've got very clear rules. you're disciplinarian, you're authoritarian, and yet in the workplace, when you're hanging out with people with fully developed prefrontal cortices and you're hanging out in a real estate company, you might be more psychologically flexible in that I have all these different types of personalities from people that have been hiring from all over the world, and I want to be very attuned to how I can shift of what different people need in terms of carrots and sticks to motivate them to be them best, their best version of themselves and deliver the best performance. And so yeah, you can think about psychological strengths and psychological well-being and psychological flexibility in terms of how it operates for you in different consistent domains of your life.
I think this is a question that is very important in the context of a conversation about well-being. Does psychological flexibility also allow for people to better deal with stress and anxiety?
Oh, yeah. I mean, so the first definition of the four is pursuing valued aims despite the presence of pain. And so someone that's low on flexibility, they're more in the rigid zone, is they tend to avoid those unwanted feelings, sensations, and memories that pop up into your brain as you're pursuing goals. Someone that's high in psychological flexibility, they might be more accepting of, like, hey, who wouldn't be anxious giving a talk in front of 700 people? And I'm going to acknowledge that, honor that, and say, I'd only be worried if I didn't get anxious because that would mean I didn't care. But then there's another level where you could talk about harnessing distressing experiences on the path to pursuing valued goals, where this is that I am intentionally trying to get myself to be anxious because it really makes me have this narrow focus attention on how is the audience reacting, and then let me alter my performance and the things I'm going to say based on what gets people to smile, what makes people start to take notes and think, versus what makes people sigh and yawn. Being that, to be that attentive requires a lot of energy. And so that's the anxiety makes you, like, really hone in on where's the threats, and then can I modify my behavior to reduce the threats as a public speaker? That is like the upper echelon of exceptional speakers.
So it's basically not about eliminating anxiety altogether, but perhaps repurposing
Yo, I love that term. I'm gonna steal that. Yeah,
it.
right. So we all avoid negative experiences or unwanted experiences sometimes. But if it's a regular pattern for you, especially when you're pursuing challenging endeavors, we would say is that this classifies you as lower in terms of psychological flexibility.
So one last question. Do the levels of well-being that someone experiences influence in any way the kinds of relationships they establish with other people?
Yeah, there's a number of ways to answer a question like that. One is, are people attracted to those individuals that are higher in well-being? The answer is absolutely yes. Then there's a question of what makes the ideal partner as a friend, as a coworker, as a a romantic partner. And the answer is people that are high in emotional stability and people that are tend to have a strong, secure attachment style and people who have their psychological needs met outside of the relationship, so they're not fully dependent and obsessive about the partners that they're with. And so in all of these ways, you have this link between a sense of well-being and then being in particular relationships. And then probably the greatest, most, like, the easiest avenue for acquiring well-being is having these satisfying, meaningful relationships. So those people that are lonely tend to experience, like, really low levels of well-being. And those people that have at least one, two, or three close friends that they can share almost anything and be effortlessly themselves in terms of what bothers them. They don't feel they'll be punished for that. They change. They don't feel they'll be punished for becoming a different person than they were 2 months ago. Those people with those secure relationships tend to have higher well-being. So it's a consequence of well-being. It's often a cause of well-being. And then if you experience this thing called well-being, you tend to be more attractive to other people.
So, is there any, for example, final message you would like to leave us with about well-being just before we go?
Well, these are great series of questions. I think it's really important to discern what does your well-being look like in terms of your matrix, and then what would you like it to be? And it's only by making these very clear targets that you can, to use your word, repurpose your daily environment to focus on, hey, I want to increase my self-compassion. I want to increase my sense of meaning in life. I feel like I don't have a purpose, and yet I feel like I'm enjoying my life. I'd like to work on that. You need to know which dimensions are the ones you want to be attending to. And by then, you can then deconstruct specific small, tiny units of behavior to move in the direction of the type of person with a particular type of well-being that you would like to become. So this is not something that is out of reach, even if you're at lower strata in terms of socioeconomic status and class. These aren't walled off to you. You can feel autonomous and you can feel meaning and you can have social relationships, even if you're just barely financially surviving in terms of your economic life. And so this is not something for just the privileged. These are psychological and social experiences that you can acquire, and most of them don't cost a thing financially.
So, Dr. Cashden, where can people find you and your work on the internet?
Well, probably the best way now is if you go to my website, toddcashin.com, and on there you will find a sign up for my Provoke newsletter, which is free, and you get all psychological tidbits at least once a week.
Great. So I will be leaving links to that and also to our first conversation in the description box of this interview. And thank you so much again for taking the time to come on the show. And I hope to have you again on somewhere in the future.
You have a continually, I'm reminded of how wide of a breadth of knowledge of psychology you have. So thanks for inundating me with some interesting questions.
Hi guys, thank you for watching this interview until the end. If you like what I'm doing and to keep the channel sustainable, please consider supporting me on Patreon or PayPal. All of the links are in the description box of this interview. Otherwise, and if you like what I'm doing, please share it, leave a like, and hit the subscription button. This show is brought to you by Enlights, Learning and Development Done Differently. Check the website at enlights.com. I would also like to give a huge thank you to my main patrons and PayPal supporters, Karen Litzke and Blanchett Perga Larsen, Lau Guerrero, Francis Ford, Hans Frederick Sunder, Ricardo Vladimiro, Craig Healy, Adam Castle, Olaf Alex, Jonathan Wiesel, Jacob Klinkby, Matthew Whittingbird, Arno Wolf, Tim Hollis, Henrik Alenia, John Connors, Paulina Baron, Philip Force Connolly, Jerry Mueller, Herbert Gintis, Rutger Voss, Bo Weingard, Rebecca Neuberger, Goldstein, Dan Demetri, Robert Windegar, Rui Narciu, Arthur Coe, Zup, Marco Neves, Colin Holbrook, Susan Pinker, Bernardo Seixas, Pablo Santurbano, Simon Columbus, Jorge Espinha, Phil Kavanagh, Corey Clark, Mark Blyth, Roberto Nguanzo, Mikkel Stormir, Eric Neumann, Samuel Andreev, Tiago Nunes, Bernardini, Alexander Dannbauer, Fergal Cousin, Ivan Bodrin, Paul Herzog, Don Ross, Jonathan Librand, Hazel Bullitt, Nathan Nguyen, Stanton T., Samuel Correa, Eric Hines, Mark Smith, J.W. João Oeira, Tom Hummel, David Sloan Wilson, Yacila Deja Araújo, Romain Roach, Dmitry Grigoriev, Diego Londoño Correa, Tom Roth, Yannick Punter, Adana Rusmani, Charlotte Bliss, Nicole Barbaro, Adam Hunt, Pavlo Stazebski, Nelek Bach, Catherine and Patrick Tobin, Al Ortiz, Guy Madison, Gary G. Hellman, João Linhares, Lida Cosmidis, Saima Afzal, Adrian Yeagi, Nick Golden, Paulo Tolentino, João Barbosa, Jules Price, Edward Hall, Edin Bronner, Franca Bortolotti, Gabriel Pons Cortez, Ursula Litzke, Dennis Cook, Scott, Zachary Fish, Tim Duffy, Todd Shackelford, Sunny Smith, and John Wiseman. My producers, Cesar Webb, Jim Frank, Lucas Stefaniak, Luis Caetano, Tom Wagner, Dan Curtis Dixon, João Linhares, Benedict Mueller, Vega Guidi, Sardis Francis, Thomas Trumbull, and Nuno Welder, and my executive producers, Michel Rugieski, Rosie, James Pratt, Matthew Lavender, Sergio Quadriano, and Bogdan Canivets. Thank you for all.